So my name is Mark Simos. I'm with our Enterprise Cybersecurity Group. I worry about strategy and how do we bring together all the Microsoft capabilities and put them in a form that that makes sense to our customers and can help fit into the initiatives that they're driving. And so that's an area that I focus on almost exclusively.
And I'm Ryan Puffer. I am a program manager on the Windows Server Assurance team. I listen to Mark's problems, and then we try to make solutions that help solve them.
Cool. So we're going to be talking to you today about securing privilege access from active attacks. I wanted to ask a question. How many folks here think Microsoft has between 5 and 10 security capabilities that you need to pay attention to? Okay. How many think 10 to 20? More? So one of the things I've been working on is a reference architecture. I'm going to show you guys a draft of it. This isn't final. It isn't fully done. There might be a couple acronyms or things that are wrong. But I wanted to start by just giving you a sense of where Microsoft is spending our time investing from a security standpoint. OK, I'm going to call this stunned silence. How many folks think this is useful? Cool. Excellent. So I'll talk a little bit about it in the areas that we're going to be focusing on in this talk. I just wanted to start with this, give you guys a little preview of some of the stuff that we're working on to help guide you through the interesting complexities of security. So the areas we're going to be focusing on, so see that big red box that spans across the middle there? Privilege access workstations, that is a key cornerstone of protecting anything of importance. Most importantly and most notably, protecting domain admins, enterprise admins. That's usually what we see the attackers go after. And that gets you a durable control and defense against those types of attacks, which is a large part of today's talk. The Just Enough admin fits in that little oval there for the Windows Server 2016 security. And there's a couple of other pieces as well. The MIMPAM we'll be referencing and the ATA as well, which fit in that purple identity and access column. So just to give you guys a heads up that essentially what we're going to be doing is navigating you through a select few of these that address the problems and the solutions to the typical major breaches that we see. I work in the cybersecurity group. We do a lot of different things on the cybersecurity group. One of them is that we have an incident response team. So if there's an active incident, there's an attacker in your environment, we're the guys that, you know, darken the skies, send the team on site, and help investigate, help recover. So those folks live on our team, and we've taken a lot of the lessons learned from those engagements, from those investigations and recovery actions, and not only fed them to Ryan and the product group, but also fed them into the guidance that we're going to be talking about today to help you guys protect against these breaches so you don't end up in those situations. And our team is very active on the investigation front. There's very few weeks that go by that we aren't investigating an active major breach at a company. We tend to be discreet, so you don't see us all over the news. So, but it is something that we do quite a bit. And we're really about bringing those lessons learned to you guys. So when we take a step back from kind of the technical details for a moment, and we think about where should organizations be going as you talk about not only the cyber threats that we're experiencing, but also the transformation that's going on in both business and IT with what's been termed as digital transformation, which is really just about modernizing business processes to embrace all of these new capabilities that have come along in the past 5 to 10 years. And so when we think about what a secure modern enterprise needs to look like through the security lens, there's two things. The high water marks are that they're aligned to the business objective. What is the business trying to do? And they're aligned to the threat environment. What are the attackers doing at this point in time? And really, those are the two North Stars, if you could have two North Stars, that really are what we think about guiding an enterprise security strategy. When we break it down a little bit further, when you think about like a secure platform, which is where most of us work, it breaks down into four different things. Identity, apps, and data infrastructure and devices. You can divide this up in a bunch of different ways, but generally that's the way that it breaks up. And when we look at the high water mark of each of these pieces, identity, the high water mark is really about establishing identity as your primary security perimeter. Back in the days of sort of the castle security mentality, You had control over everything as the IT shop, the networks, the hosts, the apps, the data. IT could set policies and enforce policies. They had control over it. But when you look at the cloud and the way that it's transformed things, the reality is that your boundary between what's outside the company, what's inside that needs to be protected, actually is not defined by the network anymore, because it's in your mobile devices your users carrying around that they may have bought. It is in the cloud. It's in the cloud software as a service that is out there, and somewhere in there is an authorized boundary between your stuff and what the cloud provider and other people control in their tenants. So really, identity, which is composed of authentication, authorization, is that security perimeter. And we'll talk a little bit about more of that later. But really about embracing that, that's the key, and then defending that like it's truly a security perimeter. Keeping an eye on it, doing conditional access, there's a lot of pieces that come into play. But ultimately, that is the new security perimeter. Network is still there to protect the corporate physical assets there, but it is not the primary one. Apps and data, really about aligning to the business. Infrastructure is really about embracing cloud. When we think about this, when you look at a cloud infrastructure, it's very consistent, very well managed, because it has to be done at hyperscale. And it's very, very difficult to replicate that level of consistency and hygiene on-premise just simply from a scale perspective. It's actually really interesting. It's becoming more and more difficult for us as we mature what we're doing in the cloud for our security and management to relate that to what normal IT enterprise environments are, because when everything is automated completely across millions of servers, you have a very different way of thinking than when you can actually go and individually touch or manage a single server. And it's a very interesting thing. We're having to boil things to their core essence to make sure to relate them between what we do on our cloud platform and what's happening within our customer tenants and our customer environments. So continuing on, so we see infrastructure there is, you know, really embracing the cloud, one, for those reasons, and all the great analysis like you can get in Azure Security Center. But also the other piece is that you can also use the cloud to protect your infrastructure. So when we look at the future of threat intelligence, the future of threat detection, it's very hard not to look at the cloud and say this is the future of threat intelligence, because the adversaries are moving at real time, and their attacks are evolving and changing at real time. And if you have an on-premise application, whether we make it or somebody else makes it, that is not tied into that intelligence, so that if it's discovered on one customer, it can be automatically added in and used to detect that same threat across all customers. If you don't have that, it's almost like a kind of blindness. And so we really see the future of infrastructure drawing from the cloud as well. So that's the big theme in infrastructure, is really taking a look at the cloud, not only to protect the new stuff, but also to protect the stuff that you've already got on-premise. And then devices. Devices are your front line. You got to do detection, you got to do prevention, you got to protect that front line. You got to expect that it will be breached. Doesn't mean that, you know, you're going to stop investing in it just because users are going to click on a phishing email. How many people think users click on phishing emails? Okay, you're still paying attention, good. So the reality is they're going to breach it, but you got to have detection, you got to have response, and then you got to have learning to go ahead and keep protecting that. So when you pull all this together, this is what we really think is happening in the world of enterprise security, and we really want to get customers to what we call a secure modern enterprise. And I'll talk a little bit about the details of that as we get towards the end. So when we take a little bit closer zoom on that identity pillar, we see a lot of identity challenges that are, from a security standpoint, that are really tough to address. And the bulk of them fit into what we are calling privileged access. And privileged access is the risks within the identity space that could lead to loss of privileged access, whether that's a server admin, whether that's a domain admin, whether that's the administrator of a very sensitive research project, but ultimately that privilege access, as opposed to, you know, which is a small number of select accounts, smaller the better, versus a wide swath of every single user account. And there are security measures on that, but we're not going to be focusing on those as much in this roadmap we're going to discuss as we are on the privilege access. Make sense? So when you take a look at a modern enterprise, does this look familiar? Got branch offices, you got on-prem data centers, you probably have some cloud, you probably have different kinds of cloud, you've got software as a service, you got to deal with customers and partners, got a bunch of mobile devices. You got a lot of stuff to manage. And when we talk about, you know, how do you look at this from a security standpoint and how do you defend all of this stuff, which is far outside of your network boundary in many cases, ultimately you're really looking at a security perimeter that can only be drawn at the identity layer. And identity, again, referring to authentication, authorization. Who are we trusting to give permission to this? And, you know, who have we given it to? That's the key. And in many cases, it's Azure Active Directory and Active Directory. A lot of other identity systems frequently get added to the mix as well. But ultimately, defending those as the perimeter themselves and then identifying where that goes and drawing the inside-outside well is where we see the future of security going. The attackers are already there. And who controls this perimeter? Anyone? Jump in. Admins. Your IT admins are the guys that are on the front line. They haven't been told that they're the guy at the border holding the gun at the station in that lonely position, but they are. They're targets. They're at the front lines. And the reality is the attackers are going after them because if they pop one admin, they get all the users. They get all the accounts. They get all the data. It's a shortcut. It's very efficient. Of all the groups that we track and investigate and all that kind of stuff that we do with our incident response and threat detection stuff, there are very few of them that actually spend the time figuring out which user to target. There are some. They do that. Some of them, that's their MO. They want to target the CEO and try and get a wire transfer or this or that. There's groups that do that. But from a volume perspective of what we see, especially related to the major breaches like you see on the news, in most cases, they just went after the admins and got access to everything and then found the data they wanted. They did not bother doing that research ahead of time. And of course, with an admin, one small mistake could give them control of what the admin has, which gives the attacker lots and lots of options. They can go after the data with the admin account. They can create fake accounts so they can stick around. They can modify documents, impersonate users. We're even starting to see the tools that we see in targeted attacks being used in ransomware. The maturity of how the attackers are using it is not the same because it's a little bit more crude and not as refined, but we are seeing those same tools starting to be used in the ransomware attacks. So it's not necessarily popping one box at a time, one user at a time opportunistically and locking it. We're actually seeing them go and try and take organizations as a whole. And they are using the same tool sets, the Mimikatz and the other credential theft stuff. So when we take a look at the typical targeted attack chain, it almost always starts from a phishing attack. It doesn't have to. In fact, those ransomware attacks that I mentioned, which are more about monetizing your ability to do work rather than monetizing your data, you know, out of your view, in those cases, they actually came in through web servers, unpatched web servers sitting on the internet. That was the most frequent way that we saw those early enterprise ransomware, for lack of a better term, attacks happen. But in most cases that we see, almost exclusively, it starts from a phishing attack. So what we see, if I can point in the right place, attacker takes over the first machine. They do have to own the whole machine. But once they take over that whole machine, they can't just own the user account that's a standard user. So that is a good first line of defense. If you've done that, it's a good thing to add to your strategy if you haven't. And then once they have admin access to that first machine, they start stealing credentials. Their favorites typically include the local admin, the built-in local admin, and the password and password hash associated with that. How many folks here have randomized or made unique each individual password on their local workstations? Awesome. We're sitting at about 50% of the room. That is phenomenal. That's a big increase from what I've seen in times past. And so you guys are in very good shape there. The problem, though, is that it's not just the local admin. They can and do lure help desk folks to the machines by creating technical issues if they need to. And so we do see some challenges around that as well, which is why we included some of the just-in-time stuff in the roadmap. But ultimately, they get a credential that allows them to get to the rest of the machines or to the next machine, and they hunt around and find domain admin. The reason for that is it's just easy. When I say domain admin, it's shorthand for domain admin, enterprise admin, operations admin. There's a whole bunch of terms for it. But ultimately, once they get that, they are sharing control of the environment with you. And at that technical level of control, they and you have the ability to modify any workstation, any server, and just about any piece of data in that environment for the most part. Sometimes it's directly joined to the domain. Sometimes it's a trust relationship. Sometimes it's something that's managed by a tool that is joined to the domain. There's a lot of paths for it, but ultimately they generally get access to just about everything. There is a public demo on this, about 10 minutes or so, 9.5 minutes recorded on it. Gives you all the gory technical details and what works, what doesn't work, and you know, just as a little bit of a sneak peek preview, no, Runas does not protect you against this. That's one of the biggest myths that we see, is people believe that I did it in a Runas window and I'm protected. The reality is no. That credential still was typed on the box with the same keyboard drivers. It's still sitting in the LSAS memory, and it can still be stolen. Another question that frequently comes up is, what about Credential Guard? I've heard about this great technology from Microsoft. It is a great technology. It's phenomenal. It does not allow you to steal the credentials and reuse them anywhere else. However, the one thing that we can't stop with that is that an adversary can park on there with their malware and operate from that workstation or server or wherever they have it and impersonate that user using the credentials that they can't steal, but they're an authorized process on the machine so they can use that. So Credential Guard, phenomenal, great technology. Definitely want you to deploy it. Definitely want to see it on every workstation to create that attacker cost, to create resistance as they try to navigate the environment. Absolutely want you to do that. Great technology. Would I bet my, you know, 10, 50, 100,000 user enterprise on just Credential Guard without actually adding the hygiene of the admin accounts to for my admins? I personally would not. I would want it there. I'd want it across my user base. I would want it protecting there, adding that attacker cost, slowing them down, making it harder to do their job, forcing them to have malware on there that I can use to detect them. Absolutely love it, want it. You know, supplement that with whitelisting. Great approach. But is that enough for my admins? No. Make sense? So when we took a look at this, we wanted to give organizations very clean, clear, specific guidance. Now, does this mean that this is the perfect plan for every organization? No. Does it mean that you might have to tailor it based on stuff you've already done? Hey, I've got CyberArk, I've got Lieberman, I've got Thycotic, I've got this, I've done this, I've built my own tool to randomize passwords. Great. Skip those steps. But this is the stuff that we feel from a basic hygiene standpoint gets you to the point where you're protected against the typical attack chain that we see in almost every attack. You guys know how frequently we investigate. Only a couple of times have we not seen credential theft as a part of it. Very few exceptions. For the most part, it's normal, it's boring. When I ask the IR team what's new, they're like, nothing. There was a new piece of malware because they fished differently. Big deal. The rest of the attack was exactly the same. So all of this guidance is actually published in document form, and we even screenshotted the graphics from this deck. For that, so it's very consistent with what you're seeing here. When we break the problem down, we first look at credential theft and abuse, because that's the typical thing and the most important thing that we worry about. And there's three parts of that. You want to prevent that escalation. You want to prevent that jump from, I went from owning one workstation to finding a domain admin credential and jumping up, and it became, you know, went from a whack-a-mole problem where you're hunting down each one-at-a-time machine the attacker gets into an enterprise-wide problem. That's the first priority. We want to stop that jump because the impact and the potential adversary damage increases, I don't even know if it's exponentially, but it's massively. You want to stop the lateral traversal with the random localized passwords and the just-in-time permissions, which we'll talk about. And you want to increase privilege usage and visibility. You want to see what's going on and be able to understand that and be able to react to it. Because if you don't know what's happening on your environment, it's very hard to react and contain the time of the attack. The other pieces that we see frequently from a fallback standpoint is after the attacker can't do that. We've seen them when they're targeting enterprises. Fallback can find misconfigurations and weaknesses in domain controllers. And so we want to harden the configuration of those. And specifically, one part of configuration that we pulled out of that was we want to reduce the agent attack surface. If you have a management agent or a security agent or some other agent running as system on a domain controller, you have another system that is equivalent in control to the domain controller because it can run arbitrary code on that, pull all the credentials, dump the DIT, all that kind of stuff. So anything that you have as an agent on there is an equivalent risk as your domain admins. Direct control of the domain controller. Next piece, least privilege. How many folks have not heard of least privilege? You want to make sure that the tier model, which is published as part of all this guidance, which basically says, I don't want my server admins to control my DCs, I don't want my workstation admins to control my servers or my DCs, and making sure that through credential exposure, which is the core of this, we're not allowing that control. You want to supplement that and make sure that through my group memberships, through the permissions in my Active Directory, I'm not also providing a path of control from a lower level, lower tier, lower trust account to actually control the whole thing. Make sense? And last, attack detection. You want to know that the attackers are out there, and you want to bound them by time. Because when you put yourself in the mindset of an attacker and you're trying to navigate an environment that you may have done a little research on or a lot of research on, the last thing you want to do is have someone there detect you and force you into a position where you have to keep evading them before you can get to your goal of stealing your data. You want to just be able to do it quietly and steal the data and not have to deal with the defenders. And so detecting attacks is an absolutely critical component of this. So when we take a look at this, what's the first step? What is the most effective things that I can do the quickest? First of all, probably been doing it for a while, separate admin account from admin for admin tasks. Do not do stuff as admin that you should be doing as a separate user account. Absolutely need that separation. Well-known, well-established best practice, probably even goes back to the mainframe days. I don't, but I would expect it very likely could. Second thing is we have to extend that concept. One of the things we've learned from the attacks that we've seen is that you cannot do it on account alone, because if you use that account on a machine where you browse the internet, where you're subject to phishing email attacks, you're absolutely at risk of losing that credential like that. And we see it happen over and over again. So you actually have to have a separate operating system for those admins, what we call privilege access workstation or PAW. And this practice, we follow within Microsoft extensively. We've kept very close tabs between what we do with our customers and our consulting arm and what our Microsoft IT folks do internally, and we keep those things very closely. We ended up not having the same name. They call it Secure Access Workstation. We call it Privilege Access Workstation. Technically, exactly the same solution, and the admin force that we refer to later, we also use in numerous instances to protect our internal systems as well. So new practice, got to do it, just part of the deal now. Next, local admin passwords. You want them random. You want them unique. Sounds like there's a lot of progress in this room. Love to hear it. Great to see it. Absolutely encourage it. Also want to do it on servers. We want to make sure if you pop one of those servers, one of those workstations, you cannot automatically, using the local account, get access to all of the other systems configured the same way. And if you do that against current attacks, you're doing pretty good. Not the absolute best you could be doing, but you know what? In 2 to 4 weeks' time, properly motivated to get it done in that time, we've seen some customers that take a little longer, you're doing really good, but you're not done. So the next stage is designed to fit in about a quarter's worth of time in most environments. Again, how long it takes in your organization through change control and processes and what technology is available, et cetera, may take longer or shorter, but we think you can get this done in about a quarter. You want to extend that privilege access workstation from not just the domain admins and the enterprise admins that were in the first stage. You want to have that for all of your server admins and all of your sensitive workloads. Like, hey, these are the guys that administer the system that does $1 billion or $1 trillion worth of financial transactions. Very good place to put a privilege access workstation. These are the guys that manage our unpatented trade secrets that, you know, if we lose these, we have no protections. Very good place for that architecture. But primarily, we look at the IT admins as a universal thing that most folks have, who are the server admins that patch all the servers, that manage them, that troubleshoot them. Let's get them working on these. And of course, help desk as well. You want to have the folks that are doing the frontline stuff doing that. And there's some configurations in there as well where you can use either remote credential guard or a feature of RDP so that when you administer those machines, you're not actually exposing the credentials on the remote machines, on those machines where the users are clicking on phishing emails. Oh, I'm sorry. Browsing the internet and clicking on links. Next thing, time-bound privileges. So we have a MIM feature, a Microsoft Identity Manager feature called PAM, and set that up, and you can have just-in-time privileges so that the users are not going around with permanent privileges. So this is a MIM capability. There's plenty of others on the market that you've seen on the Expo show floor. Lieberman, Thycotic, and CyberArk are the three that come to mind, but there's actually quite a few in this space. I think even Dell or Quest had one. But ultimately, lots of capabilities out there that can do it. We have ours. You can use either one. You get the same effect. If you've already got one, great. Just do the rest of the roadmap and keep on going, and life is good. The one interesting thing that we found about this, actually, is if you don't have multi-factor authentication, you can use this as a quick way to get multi-factor protection for your admin privileges. Not necessarily the full account, but just the privileges themselves. So this is a pretty neat trick to not have to put a full smart card infrastructure out there to support all this, and you can get MFA through the escalation process. So we found that was a nice optimization. Next one, Ryan's going to be demonstrating and talking about quite a bit, Just Enough Admin. So this is something, how many folks have heard of Jia, Just Enough Admin? Oh, excellent. How many folks are using it? Oh, wow, we went from about 80% to about 5%, to be generous. So Just Enough Admin is a phenomenal technology, and Ryan's going to be helping you guys understand and feel much more comfortable with it, show you a demo, show you how it works. This is a technology that allows you to get to least privilege. So when you think about the challenges of, I can't take domain admin away from this guy because he needs to patch the domain controllers. My domain admins do not want to patch the domain controllers. Is that familiar? Okay, laughing and hands, good. All right. Just Enough Admin allows you to perform specific tasks that would normally require administrative rights without requiring them. Not everything an admin could do, but you can pre-designate, you can run these tasks, which are a very fixed function, and it allows you to manage those DCs. I'm not going to steal Ryan's thunder. He's going to give the demo and jump in a lot more depth. Phenomenal technology to help you reduce that admin count. And then next piece, what we talked about on the agents. Less agents on the DCs, get to baseline configurations. There's a bunch of hygiene stuff you can do around there. That link gets you some more information on the kinds of stuff you can do. The number one thing to worry about there, agents. Less agents, less management tools on the domain controllers because it's less systems you have to harden. You have two choices when you're looking at these things. Do I prune it? Do I take it away and say, I don't want to have to worry about this? Or do I harden it? Because you know what? I need this to manage my DCs. So I now have to protect all of the admins in the systems of this as if they're domain controllers, as if they're domain admins. They're going to have to get a PAW. They're going to have to go through all that process. A lot of them are going to say, you know what? I really don't need to manage those DCs. And that's fine. But you need to either prune it or harden it. Those are your two choices when you find one of these things that control your, that can control your domain controller, and ultimately your enterprise. Last piece, attack detection. How many folks here have heard of ATA, Advanced Threat Analytics? Okay, good half of the room. Phenomenal detection technology, two parts to it. One, immediate attack detection. These are signatures of attacks that we have seen, or be not necessarily signatures, but these are specific things that we know are absolutely an attack, are absolutely not legitimate admin or user usage, right? Instantly, as soon as you turn it on. Then there's a second piece of it that the industry is calling UEBA, User and Entity Behavioral Analytics. This is where the system learns what normal is. It learns what's normal for your environment, and if it detects an anomaly like, hey, John Smith here never logs in from this country, never logs onto this machine, and yet he just did, I'm going to throw an alert. As well as other things that could indicate attacks like, you know, golden ticket and pass the hash and all those kind of pieces, a lot of detection stuff in there. Highly recommend that. If you've already got UEBA and you're comfortable with a very large SIM system, great. But definitely recommend looking at the ATA piece because it's critical visibility into these attacks. So you put all these things in place, and within the space of a quarter, you've got yourself a lot of progress on the important stuff. A lot of progress. And we purposely selected the technologies and the capabilities and the changes, because it's a mix of process and technology that will change your risk posture. This will put you way ahead of where the adversary current techniques are. This will force them to go back to the drawing board and spend time and money to figure out how to attack you. If they really don't care about you, they just care about someone in your industry or someone to target, they'll probably go somewhere else. If they're really after you, this is going to slow them down and make them spend a lot more money to compromise you, which means they're going to get a lot less from you than they would normally get. It's all about attacker cost. You want to raise attacker cost. That is the absolute ultimate goal of what we're trying to do, is raise adversary cost. Third one, you want to modernize your roles and delegation model. Again, I mentioned that we have this tier model of tier 0, tier 1, tier 2, and ultimately, you want to make sure that all of your roles, your delegations, your permissions match this. You want to make sure that there are no anomalies that allow someone, oh, yeah, we kind of changed the admin SD holder permission about 7 or 8 or 10 years ago, and when the adversaries couldn't use credential theft, they researched our Active Directory and they kind of got back into domain admin again. That's a true story. That actually happened to a very large enterprise. They had forgotten that they had changed and modified that particular object, which affects all of their administrative objects in AD, and they had gotten and they had lost control of their environment. So absolutely need to take a look at that tier model, take a look at your important stuff, and make sure that the permissions and delegations that are part of Active Directory, some of which are 16, 18 years old now, wow, they can actually drive a car in the US. We see stuff like this, and the adversaries that want to stay in and are really targeting, in this case, this particular large enterprise, they are absolutely doing that research. And so as you move into that, you've covered all the sort of generic bases in the first two stages. You need to get into that space and start looking at those risks. Next, smart card or password authentication. Get into full MFA for your admins, not just on the workflow process. If you're already here, great, check the box, move on. But you want to have the smart cards for admins as a way to bolster up. The PAW is more important, more effective, more sustainable, because the PAW plus this is very strong. This without the PAW, without the admin workstation, the adversary can just steal it, and they may not even notice you have smart cards because it's still an NT hash, it's still a Kerberos ticket that you get to after the two factors are validated. So it becomes one factor at the protocol level. So you absolutely have to do the admin workstation before this. That's why it's here. Next piece that we see, admin forest. This may or may not suit everyone, but what we find is organizations that can't get rid of their Active Directory, can't build a new one, and still have to operate that 10, 12, 16-year-old Active Directory, but they don't quite trust it, frequently want to up the admin workstation so that it no longer has a dependency on the production environment. They want to have that joined to an external forest and do the management of the forest from the external forest. There's a couple of benefits to this, which include the fact that you can have someone that has no control over their own account. So you can make them a standard user in the admin forest, administrator in production, and they can't modify the controls, the requirements, the IPsec rules, all of those pieces of the architecture. They can't modify it. And so the only thing they can do in that workstation is to do their job to administer production. Now, they can still mess with production. That's their job. But they cannot actually take the things that annoy them off. And so we find a lot of organizations are attracted to that architecture. It's a very powerful approach. And the way that we've built it, we've got some documentation up there on it. It's honestly over 1,000 pages of internal MCS documentation or consulting documentation. We have not figured out a way to publish that you guys would be successful on average on. It's something that takes our consultants, you know, a bunch of training and support to be able to successfully deploy, and they do this stuff every day. So it's actually a challenge for us to figure out how to open that up to you guys. So it's not something that we fully opened up. If you got all those great skills, we got all the requirements that describe the architecture so that someone that, if you've got the IPsec person, the smart card person, the this, the that, you can pretty much figure it out from the stuff that we've done. But the reality is getting those thousands of pages of documents out in a way that we know people will be generally successful with and not yelling at us because, hey, this didn't work for me. That's actually a challenge for us, and we're still trying to figure out how to solve that. But ultimately, we see a lot of organizations step up to that level because they need it. Next, Server 2016. So there's a couple pieces in Server 2016 that are absolutely super value and critical that we think really apply well to this. Code integrity policy for DCs. This is stuff that was introduced in Windows 10. It's an evolution of stuff that's been in Windows and evolving on every release since then. And the latest and greatest has come to the 2016 release, and there are some significant hardware-backed assurances where the TPM chip is doing some guarantees and validation of the operating system and the boot sequence that make you have a lot higher level of trust and integrity on the domain controllers. And we're also seeing more and more servers shipping with the TPMs as well that make this viable where it wasn't necessarily before. And then the other piece, how many folks have virtual DCs? Just about everyone. So do you like the knowing that anyone that's a VM admin can effectively grab a copy of that DC and crack the password database offline and have a good time with that? Anyone like that? OK, one dude who is being sarcastic. So most people don't like having to deal with that risk. They don't want to have to secure their VM admins. They don't want to have to go through all that process of saying, this is a dependency, a security dependency of my domain controllers. I need to lock this down. So what we do in this space is we've introduced a technology in Server 2016 called Shielded VMs. How many have heard of this? Excellent. And the Shielded VM technology allows you to virtualize DCs without adding that whole problem of how do I secure my virtualization stack at that level. And so you can essentially isolate the virtual machine DC from the control of the infrastructure. Now you have to do a little bit of infrastructure assurance. You have to make sure that, you know, to really have the assurance you want, you have to run them on Hyper-V with a TPM chip so that you have that the virtual TPM being backed by a physical TPM, which is a critical part of the trust chain in a lot of enterprises. But essentially this isolates your VMs from the hosts. And it allows the people that are admins on the host nothing. If someone's an admin on that host, doesn't matter, can't violate the VMs, can't get into the memory, the disk is encrypted, can't see it, keeps them out of it. Now, would this stop the world's top hackers? I don't know. They might be able to find a way around it. But this simplifies your hardening piece because it increases the cost of attack significantly. They can't just go grab a VM admin, grab the DC image, and party on, go to town. They actually have to do a lot of real work, which we have not yet seen in the wild. Make sense? So you go through all this, and you're at a point where you've got about as good as a security guy is ever going to give you. We will never give you full green, but this is about as good as you can get on the elements that matter in a privileged access attack. So you'll see there's a little bit of gray at the end there, so we're never going to give you 100%. We're just security guys. We're paranoid. There's always a gotcha somewhere. But if you follow this roadmap, you are in a position well ahead of market, well ahead of the attacker techniques that will make it very hard for attackers to compromising you using anything we've seen. And that's why we built the roadmap in this way, is to get you as much progress as quickly as possible. And you'll notice attack detection is a little bit low. Attack detection along identity is one dimension of it. There are many aspects of attack detection. And so this is really just focusing on the privileged access piece. And that one's that dimension is more of a universal measure. So for a privileged access detection, that's really good stuff. But you've also got Defender ATP, you've got the host detection, you've got network detection. There's a lot of other things that go into it. That's why we didn't give you the high green on that one. Make sense? So with that, I'm going to see if my colleague is ready to impress you with all sorts of just enough admin demonstrations.
Thank you, Mark. Wait 1 second, guys. Get this all plugged in. Awesome. All right, so I want to show you a quick demo today of just enough admin and just in time admin to help show you why these are so important. And Mark was talking a lot about the principle of least privilege, and I own the technology Just Enough Admin, which is a PowerShell role-based access control solution, which lets you define the roles you want for anything that can be managed with PowerShell. So if you already use RBAC solutions for things like Active Directory, DNS, et cetera, you're probably familiar with its ability to help you constrain what people are able to do. The problem is a lot of those tools are limited to that very specific application. So if you're trying to manage something outside the scope of that, like say you need to restart the service because actually the whole thing crashed, that's not part of that tool set. And that's when you usually have to become a local admin of the machine. So Jia is a great way where we can avoid that because we can say a role to me means things specific for that DNS or AD patch role, plus a little more outside of the scope of that specific application. So just to show you, I'm not lying, I'm signing in here on my workstation as a standard alt account admin user. This is not actually an administrator. It's just a standard user in my admin that I use for admin tasks on my machines. If I try to go now and use PowerShell remoting to go access my domain controller, I'm going to get an access denied message. And that's simply because I didn't change the default WinRM policy on my domain controller. So the policy states that I have to be a domain admin in order to access it. But if I do the same thing again and provide a configuration name, I'm going to give it Jia. That's the name of a very specific management endpoint which one of your highly trusted admins will have set up. So for me, that's the person who is managing my DC, my actual domain admin, who realizes that I right now need to go do something on that PC, but I'm not someone he trusts as a domain admin. So I'm going to assume the role for this demo as someone who's trying to do standard network maintenance. You know, a lot of people use DNS server, install that on the same machine as their Active Directory domain controller. Unfortunately, if you need to become a local admin of a DC, you're becoming a domain admin, which gives you way too many privileges to manage something as simple as the DNS server. So if we look at what happened here, when I signed in, behind the scenes, Jia went through and mapped me to roles relevant to my current status. So I'm just doing my day-to-day stuff. I'm just a viewer. I have access to the GET commands from the DNS server module. So I can run them the same way I would with any standard PowerShell syntax. Let's do DNS server zone, see what we have on this machine. Cool, I'm getting the same output I normally would if I were using regular PowerShell, either on the box or with remoting. I'm using the same syntax, so it's not like you have to retrain your users on how to use this. And I could still pass in things, you know, like parameters, like say I need to do get win event. That's usually not part of the DNS management thing, but I can do something like DNS server, get the top five events from there, and there we go. So it lets me get my job done without actually having to be a domain admin on this machine. And that's really important, because if I were an attacker, I'd probably try something like add AD group member. And in Jia, that's just explicitly blocked. We start with nothing and build you up. And when I say we start with nothing, we don't even include the file system. You have no access to the files, the registry, anything on that system that isn't relevant to your current role. So what happens if, say, I'm doing my regular maintenance, something goes wrong, and I need more privileges on this machine in order to make a change? This is where that principle of least privilege comes back and where just-in-time administration comes in. So I'm just going to go ahead and exit my session here and hop over to Microsoft Identity Manager. This is just one of the many solutions out there that help you do privileged access management. And I'm going to go ahead and say I need to do some advanced tasks in my DNS server. Now, you notice I have a ton of different roles here. This is why it's least privilege. I start with nothing. I'm adding what I need. If I needed the RDP to this DC, I'd have to explicitly get added to a group which would give me that permission. So I'm going to use this Jia DNS admin group, and I'm going to say I want to restart the DNS service. You'll notice here on the timeout, very important thing here, I am time-bound with Windows Server 2016's time-bound groups, meaning that in exactly 30 minutes, I'm going to lose this privilege. I don't keep this forever until I decide, all right, I'm done with my work. It's actually just going to be enforced by the process here so that in 31 minutes, I'm back to my viewer role. And that's a great place to be. If I need to go use it more, I can come back to this portal, go ahead and click Extend Activation, and get more privileges. But this gives me a central place to log when and why I chose to be an admin on this machine. As Mark mentioned earlier, there's also ways here you can use Azure Multi-Factor Auth or explicit approvals from managers or peers for really sensitive tasks. So for example, I have explicit approval required if I'm going to do patch management on a DC. If you set up a bad patch on a DC, you're going to have a lot of phone calls. We don't want to have that happening. So all this did now behind the scenes is put me in a special security group. I'm still not an admin. It's just a different security group which says, hey, Ryan's now allowed to do some DNS admin tasks. So I'm going to go minimize this, going to clear my screen, and I'm going to go connect to that DC again. And I'm using the same exact Gia endpoint. I haven't changed anything here. But what's exciting is that when I come on the right side now, Gia realized that I belong to this new security group. One of the roles on my Contoso domain controller for Gia is DNS admin, DNS viewer. Now, since I'm in the admin group for the next 30 minutes, I have access to all the DNS server commands. I'm able to do things like clear DNS server cache. I have access to things like restart service DNS. But Gia's granularity goes much further than just the commandlets which you're allowed to run. You also can provide access to some of the external commands. And when you're working with a specific PowerShell design commandlet, we can actually constrain the parameters and even the values for those parameters which you're allowed to use. So if I go here and I do restart service and TDS, I'm not allowed to do that. The only things I'm allowed to restart are DNS and the DNS cache service. So Gia really helps you get to the least amount of privilege you need to get your job done. But since it's working with PowerShell, you have tons of options available to you for what that role actually means. And you can, of course, design your own functions and scripts to help get even more functionality. The last thing I want to show is probably the most important part about Gia, and that is, if I connected with a standard user, how on earth did I get to run these commands which normally require admin privileges? And that's through the use of single-use virtual accounts. So when you connect to a Gia endpoint, we're spinning up a local account, which is privileged as an administrator on that single machine. It's only for you and only for the duration of your session. So for the security auditors in the room, we always make the name of this account after your account. So we're putting an event in the audit log to say, hey, Ryan signing in as priv.demo, signed in to Gia. We want to make sure you know he was assigned this virtual account. And of course, the name in this account also includes my username. So if you're going through application event logs, you can still figure out who did stuff. And so this is what helps us constrain our privilege even more, because if, say, you're working on a file server and you're trying to dispatch it and there's some malware sitting on there, if it grabs that virtual account's identity and tries to use it on other machines, it's just a local account. It does not belong to the domain. So that account can't be used to compromise further machines. So that's it for the quick demo of JIT and Gia. Hope you guys have had a chance to see some more information or go down to the booth this week to talk to us about how you can use this in your environment to pretty much drop this in and make everything a little bit more secure. And the best part is it's available all the way down to 2008 R2 and Windows 7. So it's not even like we're making you upgrade all the way to Server 16. It's a great technology you can start using today. Thank you.
Thanks, Ryan. Really appreciate that. I always learn something new whenever I see Ryan demo that I'm like, oh, that's how that works. So the last piece of this before we get into the questions section, and we're actually doing pretty well on time, so we got plenty of time for questions, is I wanted to dive in a little bit deeper to the secure modern enterprise that we discussed earlier, and just talk about how we think about that. And this is really when we talk with our enterprise customers about, hey, how do we build a plan with you that, you know, takes the best of our knowledge and what we are seeing in the attacks and combines them with what you need and what your business goals are and what threats you might be facing? How do we build that plan together? And so the Secure Modern Enterprise is the framework that we use for doing that. And so the way that we normally do this is a two-phase approach. You know, the first part, you know, I mean, the reality is, you know, just to sum up all the stuff you've seen from the attack standpoint, The bad news is most enterprises are vulnerable to a lot of these attacks. It sounds like things are getting better. I'm really glad to see the hands and the local random passwords that you guys are doing. Very, very, very encouraging to me. And then the good news, though, is that mitigating them and the stuff that we see is actually remarkably straightforward simply because we've seen the same attack over and over again. The adversaries are very efficient, much like us. They're gonna do the same thing that works. How many folks have legacy systems that just work that you'd love to get rid of, but they just work so you don't get rid of them? Attackers are the same way. They use the same attacks because they work and they're not about to invest in inventing something else, even if they don't think it's elegant or sexy or super special. So we're gonna dive into the details of that, but ultimately it's a couple different things that follow very, very closely to the privilege access roadmap, and we'll show you that. The second piece, quite frankly, is it really depends on the organization. What are the threats that we're seeing? So once we get past that first sort of universal phase, when you take a look at how do we secure an organization, you know what, privilege access and really upping that, they may be subject to the same targeted attackers that are just gonna keep ramping it up, and they gotta drive further down that as opposed to just doing the basics. Or maybe they're going to the cloud. Maybe they've got a digital transformation initiative where they've got code that they have to run to make, you know, three partners and a vendor and a this, that work so that they can sell a new product to a customer. You know, it really depends on the organization on what sort of the next initiative is that makes sense. The first part of is very, very universal based on what we've seen from the attack landscape, what we investigate all the time. But it does get kind of a little bit unique and tailored to the organization as we get deeper down the roadmaps that we build with our customers. And you know, this is what we recommend from a secure modern enterprise perspective. You know, there's the attack chain that we saw earlier. And so the first things that we package up and help our customers with, everybody's got an AD. But every AD is a little bit different. And so we actually have to do an assessment to understand the risk profile of that specific AD. Is there a particular configuration that puts them at a particular level of risk? Is there certain things that are there? Are the patches not being applied consistently? Are they being applied consistently? There's some other things that really vary depending on the organization. We have some assessments that we run with customers to help understand that. And then everyone has admins. Most admins, in our experience, and it's getting better, are doing administration from normal workstations. Some organizations are doing them from jump servers. They connect into a jump server that's hardened down and secure. That's a step better. Does that mean that the adversary still can't fish, own the workstation that they connect from, and then capture the keystrokes, the screen, and all the things that they need to then get access to it or inject processes into it or reconnect at a later point? No. So is it as good as a privilege access workstation? No. Is it a step better than just doing it directly from your workstation? Yes. So we view jump servers as an interim step on the way to a true PAW. We strongly recommend actually using a PAW to connect to a jump server. There's other reasons to use a jump server where you would RDP into that and then do your administration from there. Single place for tools, make sure everybody's doing it up to date. Single place for logs. You know, it's good to have a choke point for a lot of reasons. But ultimately, it does not stand up to the attackers as well as a PAW would. So we set our customers up with a PAW. Next thing is random passwords. That's just rules of the road, have to do it. A lot of organizations, they may already have that, and we may actually focus on the just-in-time piece and get them a configuration either using their existing solution or using the MIM-PAM product that Ryan was demoing to get them that just-in-time privileges to protect against those lateral traversal ones, and we have to have the random passwords there. Next piece, there's two aspects to threat detection. We bring in our incident response teams to do a proactive hunt, what we call a PADS. Not the best name in the world, but it's pretty cool. It's the incident response team doing a proactive hunt using the same tools, techniques, et cetera. And we check and make sure that the organizations are in a good state of health, that they haven't missed that an attacker's been there. So detection of the past. And then, on the other hand, you also want to detect the future. This is where we bring in the ATA technology to detect future attacks that use these credential theft techniques and identify other attackers in the environment from an anomalous behavior perspective. Make sense? And then the last piece, when we do these engagements with our customers, organizational preparation. We do deep technology dives into the attackers, what they do, what they don't do, dispel a lot of myths, make sure that everybody is clear from the IT professional and the security professional perspective on exactly how these attacks work. A lot of this documentation has been published, but sometimes it helps to actually have someone present and discuss it. And then, of course, build a roadmap. So what roadmap makes sense? And we build a strategic roadmap that makes sense for them based on our experience and recommendations. So that's generally how we work with customers. You'll notice those things, so they look pretty familiar, look like the kind of stuff that we put in the roadmap. It's pretty much where we do it. And you know, this is something we do recommend for every enterprise. Not all of them take us up on it. And just marketing tagline stuff, we do bring everything that we've got to help protect everything you've got, whether it's on-prem or in the cloud. We are cloud first, mobile first. We recognize that our customers are hybrid. We absolutely want to protect all of their assets, help them protect all their assets. So I think I might have already asked some of these questions, but I wanted to kind of get some polls from the audience. How many folks here are using a dedicated workstation, a privileged access workstation today for admin tasks? Wow, we're looking at 25-30%. Excellent. Now, how many of those folks that are doing that are actually using our public guidance, the CyberPaw guidance that I referenced earlier? Okay, about 5 or 10 hands, so about half. Cool. How many folks here are using Advanced Threat Analytics or a UEBA product in a SIM? Cool. Probably about 20-25% of folks. And then ask the local password randomization on the workstations. How about on the servers? How many folks are randomizing their server passwords, local passwords? All right, again, 50-60%. Excellent. Excellent. So I think that is all of the stuff. Yep. So now it's your turn to turn the questions on me. And Ryan. Ryan, get up here. You're going to get skewered too. So I'd love to take your questions. And thank you guys very much. And please come up to the mics if you guys don't mind. That way we don't have to repeat the questions. Really appreciate that.
Hi. Admin workstation, these privileged access workstations, what are you doing as far as remote access then on them for admins working from home? Do they function then as like a jump box or?
So you can take the workstation home. Now, remoting into the workstation, we don't allow, but you can take the workstation home. In the admin forest, we have very firm controls that don't allow you to browse the internet from outside. We don't have as firm of controls on the ones that's actually browser configurations in most cases. But generally, we wouldn't want them to be browsing the internet. We would just want to restrict them to only talking to the outside of your VPN in most cases. Although we do, the one thing that we do allow on the internet browsing piece is if you are administering a cloud service. So if you're administering Azure or you're administering Office 365 with that same workstation, that's where the browser restrictions come in. And we configure it such that you can only talk to these DNS addresses and these IP ranges. Make sense?
Yeah, so you're assuming then, too, that you have that Red Forest in place?
The Red Forest does it with IPsec, and it's very firmly controlled. The guidance that we have in the privilege access workstation, how we typically implement it, it's usually done by either by your edge firewall or by browser proxy controls, where we send you to a loophole address if you're not on the authorized list. So we don't, IP addresses in the cloud hyperscale doesn't work with IP address controls, and so we do our best with the browser proxy controls.
Okay.
Thank you. Good questions.
So you mentioned about lapse on both workstations and servers.
Yes.
Maybe about a year, a couple of months ago, I think Microsoft was pushing Lapse E or encrypted lapse. Is that no longer a recommendation or is that no longer a product?
So that's not something that we deploy. Essentially, it was a custom version of the lapse piece. The reason that we ended up not recommending that and stopping deployment of that is it ended up creating another risk point in a database that had to follow all the things. So it gave you passwords that were encrypted in AD, but then it gave you a clear text database that you then had to secure, and it moved the problem. It didn't actually solve it. And so we actually stopped with that architecture and just stuck with the, hey, you know what, let's go ahead and use the LAPS basic one. And if people want to go to a Lieberman or a CyberArk that has all those features built in, great. But if they want the basic one that registers in AD, great. It didn't make sense for us, so that's why we stopped that.
So I understand from a workstation standpoint, but from a server standpoint, isn't that a huge risk to have unencrypted local admin passwords that store all your data in Active Directory?
So the passwords themselves are protected at the normal way that the NTDS DIP file is. So they are plain text in AD, but they are protected by Active Directory ACLs, which are well established. It's the same technology that keeps you from adding yourself to domain admin that protects you from ever seeing those passwords unless you're authorized. And so we actually trust that technology there. And even though it's plain text, once you have access to it, it's locked down in that same way with the same ACLs that we trust for everything else. Make sense? Thank you. Good questions.
So we tried to implement MARS before, and functionally it worked fine. And we understand with 2016, you know, it's built in. We wouldn't have to have the separate portal and stuff. But however, because of Active Directory replication, it would be an extensive amount of time for those privileges to be escalated. How is that solved with 2016?
So MARS, just for your edification, was a reference architecture that we were deploying using the FIM technology. So it was using FIM to do MIMPAM before we had MIMPAM. Now, do you feel comfortable answering that, or do you want me to take a stab?
I can't speak definitively on behalf of the MIM team. There are definitely some people downstairs who could better answer that question. The demo I showed you was live. So as far as that goes, I was working in a red forest in my demo, managing the corp forest. So my membership in the group was immediate. And that's because it's using Shadow Principles in 2016. So it's much easier to work with. They don't have to worry about replication across the whole AD forest. But I can't really say anything about what the comparison of time is because I haven't done MARS, and I couldn't tell you about the deep implementation of MIM.
The one major change that I do know about, because you know I was one of the original architects of the Red Forest, and when I saw what they did with the MIMPAM, which is really adapt those forests and combine it with the MARS architecture, I was very impressed because what they could do at the operating system level was instead of relying on that replication of, hey, the group changed and the this and that before it actually got enforced, they could integrate it in the DC and say, you know what, when the timer's up from this, because we got a signal from the MIM instance, we can actually read that and give you a Kerberos ticket that only is good for the time that you're authorized for. And so they were able to do stuff at the operating system level that we could not as a configuration architecture level until that feature was implemented. And so that particular problem, which I think you're referencing, has been solved simply by nature of the DCs are aware of the MIMPAM in the 2016 space. I don't know if they ever backported it to allow a production DC of a lower level to be aware of that to do the lookup. I know there's a discussion around that, but I know if you have 2016 production DCs and the MIMPAM, you're good. I just don't know if you have down-level production, if it actually also works. Does that answer your question?
That helps. Thank you. One other thing. Of course, we've done the Red Forest, and that was fine, to segregate the domain admins and the enterprise admins. But what about separate forest for the other resources, like centralized services and segregating users into separate forests as well?
So the way we look at forest design is you, by default, start with a single forest, single domain. And then you add stuff as you need to. An admin forest is one of those special cases that does it. Regulation is another case that does it. You know, different countries with different laws is another reason. There's a very short list that I don't have memorized of reasons why we would ever split into different forests. We try to stay in the same forest because it's so much easier to manage, less overhead, less confusion, less opportunities to miss something that an attacker can exploit. Staying with the single domain, single forest for any new implementation is where we want to start, and you only vary from that as you have a very specific requirement. In the case of Red Forest, that's a very specific technical security risk that we address with it.
Thank you.
I was curious if the MIM technology you demoed up here was a cloud-based portal, or is that does that require infrastructure on-premise?
So what I showed you was Microsoft Identity Manager on-prem. The same team also builds the just-in-time solution for Azure Active Directory. So there is one for both. They're not one unified system at this time. But what I was showing was entirely on-prem. You install it on your own server, configure it with your own domain.
Okay, so the one in the cloud is only for the cloud accounts.
That's correct for now. Okay. Yep.
With the GIA that you showed, it was administering Active Directory mainly. Do people use it for other systems like Exchange, TFS, SharePoint?
Absolutely. You're in full control with GIA about what the roles are. So we're shipping some sample roles. They're up on our GitHub. They're based on what MSIT has used GIA for. And as a product group, we're trying to come up with some best practices from what we know. But in the end, it's going to come down to how do you define your admins? So you have full control over exactly which commands each type of role is, and you can define as many roles as you need.
Yep. And on the JIT side, you don't have to only do IT admins. GIA tends to be a technical solution that the IT admins would use, but the JIT piece, if you want to make sure that people have to go through a workflow before they get access to a certain very sensitive piece of data so that you can do alerting and notification and whatever else you want to do on it, you can also use the just-in-time for sensitive business applications that don't have any admin privileges. So that's another scenario. The GIA, very IT admin focused.
As a follow-up to the question about using a PAR from home, is there a reason why not to use a VDI box as a PAR?
So VDI is great. You can create a lockdown, secure system that's hosted on the cloud, on an on-prem server, wherever you want it. But if you connect to it remotely and that keyboard, video, mouse could be coming from a completely compromised machine, you insert a smart card in that compromised machine, you type a PIN in that machine, you type the password in that machine, all the things that you have to do to validate that you are you to that VDI are all under the control of that potentially compromised machine. And so you'd need a PAW to access it anyway, so are you adding value by adding the jump? And so that's the reason that we approach it in that way is, you know, the ideal thing is just put everything on a PAW and manage it and make it a wonderful experience so the admins love it. With all the tools that they want, all that kind of stuff. That's the way we approach it, because the jump server thing, it's a good interim step. You can do it on a VDI, great, but is that going to be anywhere near as strong as a PAW and stand up to future attacker techniques? No. Make sense?
Yeah, the trouble is if you have a PAW workstation without access to internet, then you have to bring two laptops.
When you say internet, now you can allow it to VPN in and get to the corpnet and then run through your normal set of edge controls. When we say internet, we have to be very careful to define. We keep them from going to the open internet and browsing around Facebook and all these things that have absolutely no relation to their IT admin role. And so that's the internet that we're trying to keep them away from, not the authorized services they have to manage and the VPNs to get into the network.
I understand, but within our company, with the new way of working, you have pretty unlimited access to internet. So for your admins, then you would need two workstations, one protected to do their admin tasks and one more or less open.
You need two operating systems. You can have a physical PAW that runs either a VDI or a VM or a remote desktop or whatever that does user tasks. But you have to have a trustworthy base, because that base can always take control of the VM or the RDS session. You can't have a user accessing an admin or an admin VM on top of it. But you can have an admin host that has a VM or RDS session that gets them all their user apps on it. So that's the way we do it, is we start with, and this is all documented in the PAW documentation, you start with that trusted host, and then you add the user risky tasks in the sandbox, not the other way around. Make sense?
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
So you're talking about having a separate workstation to do admin work in the domain.
Yep.
And we know nowadays one of the recommendations is to have two-factor authentication.
Mm-hmm.
With that being said, what is the relevance you're having one single smart card where you map your regular account and also have your admin account mapped to the same card?
Good question. So if you have a single smart card that is able to log on as an admin or user, it's better than having passwords, because you still have to have the smart card. But if you're inserting it in there and it's the same PIN that accesses either credential, the adversary can still PIN steal off the user one and then attack on the admin one. Now, it's a difficult thing to do. It's not an easy thing to do because they have to sort of work those pieces in there and find a way to convince the admin to plug in the admin one and be able to put the pin in. So it's not a perfect solution. It's better, but if you're going to go through all that trouble of a separate workstation, most of the time people will just have a separate smart card just to keep it simple and easy. And the thing that we like about the two physical workstations is we've noticed at customers, people treat it differently. When it's a console that's dedicated to the admin task or the sensitive whatever it is task, people really treat it differently and they think about it differently. And it becomes something special psychologically. And so that's a really good effect that we like for your enterprise domain admins, your super high impact stuff, and throwing an extra smart card on that's no big deal. But if you've got someone that's got day-to-day stuff and you can't do, you know, 1,000 help desk people with two different physical boxes, yeah, we recognize there's scenarios where you want to do a user VM on an admin host. Lots and lots of scenarios where that makes sense. But we do find that the two physical things, if you're going to go for two different OSs, high impact stuff, we like the two physical separates. Make sense?
Yes, it makes sense. So in a situation where you have multiple forests that you have to manage, from that single workstation, is this still relevant to have one smart car if we will have one smart car for admin work and one smart car for regular user in multi-forest environment? What's your take on that?
There's a lot of it depends in there. When you talk about the multi-forest, do you really want an admin forest instead of just, you know, within one of the production forests? There's a lot of complexity that I can't give you just
I'm talking about like you have a production development and, I mean, if you don't want your dev and...
Prod, dev, test,
exactly.
Type of thing.
Yeah.
Again, that's, I don't have the answer offhand about what a reference architecture is on that. That's something that we'd have to talk through.
Okay,
you're welcome
to talk offline afterwards.
Yep. Thank you.
Do you have any recommendations on limiting the lateral movement capabilities of a desktop support admin or your help desk that has to go do admin write stuff on a end user device?
Yes. Essentially, what we do is a PAW, and part of the PAW usage includes setting the policies on it that require RDP restricted admin mode so that when you access those support machines, it's not exposing creds. That's how we do the best lateral protection, where simply the cred isn't there by virtue of the technology that allows you to log in.
But remote desktop doesn't help fix something in the end user session.
Oh, in the end user session? Well, as long as you don't type the admin creds in it, you can use any end user shadowing technology, be it Skype or whatever your help desk support stuff is, as long as you're doing it as a non-admin.
But you have to have admin rights sometimes to fix that end user problem.
Two different connections. One, you shadow, you figure out what the problem is. Second, you go in and you fix it as RDP restricted admin. So it's two different modes. Am I looking at the user session or am I modifying the OS? You don't do it in the same session.
So never use admin rights in the end user's session to fix something?
Correct, because the user can always steal them anyway. That's one of the reasons, if you look at our old remote assistance feature, we actually blocked you unless you were admin from elevating to admin with the user account control, specifically because we didn't want the user to say, I'm going to disconnect the help desk and then run rampant as an admin. And so there's a little bit of nuance there. Make sense?
Okay.
Thank you.
What's been your reception by admins subject to the JIT and GIA policies to the workflow? Do they view it as an inhibitor or a facilitator, or how do you upsell that to them?
Sure. Yeah. So we've been working closely with Microsoft's internal IT folks to try to get them to use JIT and GIA. I don't know much about their JIT implementation, but for GIA, the area where they found it really worked well was actually their change management team. Who are constantly just doing small changes on their on-prem data center. So these are the people who you call up and say, hey, I'm hosting my service on your data center. Can you please increase my RAM, change my VM name, that kind of stuff? Those are like the simple, like, they're getting a ticket. They know what they have to do. They can prescribe the task that has to be done. And for them, we've actually heard no negative feedback at all, because for them, it's pretty much the same thing they were already doing. It's just now they're doing it with a few extra parameters. It's definitely, for like investigative work, it's definitely a little bit more cumbersome because you're constrained in the environment which you're working in. And so we recommend for a lot of people, spend some time, audit what someone is normally doing in PowerShell, and say, all right, here's what they normally use. Is that sufficient for us to give them as a role? And if it is, just give it to them, and that way they already are using what they know how to use.
Yep, and from a motivation perspective, do you want your account to be the one that was part of the attack? I mean, that's the real question that they have to answer.
Okay. When your admin's using the PAW, if they have another system they use to access the internet, do they have to call the help desk if they want something changed on that system, or do they have yet another account that they don't normally log into the machine as because they don't want local admin rights surfing the internet, but they do need to install a new program, they want to add something to that
machine?
So
how do they support their own machine?
How do they support their own machine so that you're not typing creds in a box that has internet but needs admin rights to make a change?
I mean, you should be following the same procedures that the help desk would at that point. I mean, ultimately, you know, whether it's an RDP into it and fix it, I mean, that's one of the options. The other option you can use to shortcut it, which is maybe not the right way to do it because it creates, you know, essentially process inconsistencies, is you can use the local lapse randomized password, which is another valid way of doing the support for help desk, but it's very manual for them to do every day, so we tend to like the restricted admin better than that, so they don't have to constantly look up a password for every user they have to support, or every machine they have to support, to be specific.
So would they go through the just-in-time process then to go make that change?
That's an option. Now, what process works best for your help desk support and how they work it, whether it's outsourced or this, or high skill or low skill, or high trust, low trust, there's a lot of different variables to design the perfect one. And we've identified, hey, here's the in the standards that we refer to in that documentation, here's the ones that work, and here's the preferred alternates, and then here's the things that you just absolutely can't do. These are the forbidden ones. And that way you can design your process around what works.
Okay.
Yep. Last question.
I had three questions. Was that okay?
As quick as we can. We're about a minute over, so.
Is it acceptable to substitute the privileged account workstation with a physically secured lockdown thin client connecting to a jump box or a VDI configured as a PAW?
As long as you have what we call a clean source. So if you validated and you trust that thing and the way it's built and all the way through to how it does the admin work, great. Now, would I use a normal thin client that wasn't managed that, you know, any help desk guy could change and modify? That's a different story. You got to really have that clean source and good control.
At what part of the roadmap would you phase out NTLM and SMB1 from an enterprise?
So LANMAN we would phase out very early in the process if you're still using LANMAN. NTLM V1, it would probably be in the 6-month one if we found that you were using NTLM V1 and allowing it. It would probably be in that third phase is where, you know, just offhand I would think about putting it. Again, we'd have to understand the situation, the other stuff in place.
And for a service provider, do you still recommend putting the infrastructure in a separate forest?
For a service provider, generally, yeah. That tends to be a high-value environment, and so an admin forest of that would probably be a very good idea, given the business value of that, and a compromise would lead to all sorts of trust issues and customer revenue problems.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all.